Get to Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Pennsylvania's voter ID trial is attracting nationwide attention as the case continues to be heard in Commonwealth Court. At issue is the Pennsylvania requirement that voters show an acceptable form of photo identification in order to cast their ballot. The American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania and other groups are attempting to show that the law itself will restrict access to the polls. WESA's Capitol reporter Mary Wilson has been covering the voter ID trial and joins us by phone from Harrisburg. Good day, Mary.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
Mary, from the day that the voter ID law was passed in March of 2012, many saw this day coming, this day in court. Describe the mood in Commonwealth Court this week.
So the mood is at times kind of slow, like the pace of things is kind of slow and redundant, and at times almost triumphant from either side as they see themselves getting the best of whoever the lawyers are on the other side of the room. We have heard a lot of these arguments before. This law has been in court in Commonwealth Court twice before for preliminary hearings. to settle a challenge that the law should be temporarily blocked. So it's been before a judge in Commonwealth Court twice before, and so we've heard a lot of these arguments. This time there are bits and pieces of new testimony, but what's a lot of what's happening is kind of this tedious kind of reestablishment of a record of facts. Going back to testimony that was presented last year, the challengers of the law, you know, had to bring in a survey expert to sound off on a survey they presented last year to show that, yeah, the survey we presented that showed that people, eligible voters and registered voters, would be disenfranchised by this law. That survey was actually a good survey. When things kind of pick up a little bit is when there's any hint of very new evidence of a new type of witness who can speak to either the difficulty of getting IDs or the extra pains the state has taken to make sure those IDs are available. That's the best I can characterize the mood. And of course, you know, after court on the days that I was attending, a lot of, you know, back and forth from lawyers and spokesmen. Who were kind of trying to one-up each other before the press, of course.
Well, and of course, yeah, that's part of it. To the extent that the ACLU has to prove that the voter ID law in its current state disenfranchises voters, what sort of smoking gun has it produced during the course of this early stages of this trial?
So far, we've got a study, a statistical analysis from the challengers, that shows that about 500,000 people don't have a certain kind of acceptable photo ID for voting and wouldn't have it if the election were tomorrow. That 500,000 figure, about half of it includes people who have expired licenses from PennDOT or, you know, non-driving licenses or driver's licenses. And the other half, roughly, is made up of people who have no ID acceptable for voting on record with the state. Lawyers for the state counter that turns a blind eye to people who might have other kinds of ID that would be acceptable for voting under this law, which include certain ID issued by the military, certain kinds of ID from Pennsylvania universities and nursing homes.
This is an ever-expanding list of identification because, correct me if I'm wrong, but when the law was first passed in March of 2012, there was a very limited list of ID that you could use, and then we saw the list expand. College IDs became acceptable if there was an expiration date, that kind of thing. Has that list grown?
The list, I would say, is not ever expanding, but the list has expanded. It's correct that written into the law, Pennsylvania universities were ID from Pennsylvania universities are proper, are valid for voting. It became clear only in the coverage that ensued after the law was passed, I believe, that there would need to be an expiration date, because there would need to be an expiration date and a photo on those ID, that not all colleges would have ID that fit those requirements. So what we saw were a bunch of Pennsylvania universities changing their IDs or doing things like, I think Penn State was the school that decided it would apply an expiration date as a sticker, and it would hand those out to students so that their IDs that they already had would become valid for voting. So we saw that. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that added to the list of acceptable ID is that the Department of State created, in the midst of ongoing court proceedings, created a special ID card for registered voters that could be issued to them free if they had run out of options and if they could not get other ID for identification, other ID for like a driver's license. The list did expand. That's correct.
And certainly one of the gotcha moments, and it may have actually occurred when one of the ACLU lawyers was talking to the media outside the courtroom, when he said, "Do you really want your right to vote to be put in the hands of a PennDOT bureaucrat?" Because of course PennDOT is issuing those non-driver's license IDs. What can you tell us, Mary, about the two women whose videotaped testimony was shown on Monday?
These were two women. Mina Cantor-Pripstein is from Philadelphia, and Marion Baker is from Reading, or living in Reading, and living in Philadelphia and living in Reading, respectively. Two women in their 90s with difficulty walking, difficulty getting around alone, for the most part confined to their home, or Cantor-Pripstein, who lives in Philadelphia, is pretty much confined to her building, which has a lot of amenities like a supermarket that she can visit by herself for the most part. They testified that their limited mobility does not impact their ability to get to their respective polling places, which are pretty nearby their homes. They don't have trouble getting their children to drive them to the polling place or to help them get to the polling place. In the case of the woman who lives in Philadelphia, the polling place is in her building, also downstairs. They have expired licenses, I believe, and they would have difficulty getting their licenses renewed, especially if it means arranging for transportation and then walking and then waiting in line. These are women who expressed fear that they would get hurt. This was testimony presented to show that it would require undue burden on registered voters, that they have to jump through this other hoop to be able to vote. The lawyers for the state, in their cross-examination, however, pointed out that these women could still get ID if they just made the arrangements. There was testimony that I haven't written about by another senior citizen who's actually legally blind. She has not so much trouble walking physically, perhaps, but is also, I believe, in her 90s and is legally blind, so needs help. And the thing that was difficult for her was even filling out a ballot. The cross-examination, the lawyer for the state asked her, "Well, have you even tried to go stand in line? Have you even tried to get an acceptable photo ID?" The point there being that the state, according to the state, they have met their burden by making these IDs available. It requires action on the part of registered voters to make sure that they are getting those IDs. And absent action, the state can't, the state can't do anything about a voter who is not more motivated.
Sure.
The state also, it was kind of a funny moment, the lawyer cross-examining this woman I'm speaking of who's legally blind. She had been driven to the courthouse by someone who was working with the lawyers challenging the law, and he asked her if she would ask the lawyer or the driver who brought her to take her to the local PennDOT office and get an ID. He kind of like cornered her with several questions, and she finally said, "Yeah, I'll ask him."
To what extent is there a burden of proof on the state to show some evidence that addresses an actual problem of people impersonating other people in order to vote, which was the whole justification for, the state says, for creating this law in the first place.
It would appear that there is no burden at all. There was a stipulation last summer during court hearings, before the first court hearing, that that the state attorneys could not, that the state attorneys and the lawyers challenging the law agreed that they would not, the state lawyers agree that they can't point to any instances of voter impersonation and that they would not be trying to defend the law on those grounds. That was a major justification of the law. Now we're really seeing the state back away from that. The state's attorneys have also, however, moved in court, made moves to suggest that that stipulation does not apply in this hearing. A motion that, a claim, I suppose, that I don't have the legal jargon down pat, but that claim is something that the lawyers challenging the law, opponents of voter ID, disagree with. They think that that stipulation should remain in place. But outside of the court, it is certainly true that the state is really backing away, I would say, from the whole voter fraud justification. The spokesman for the attorneys arguing said a couple days ago that voter fraud, that whole discussion, he called it a misdirection. And he said what's more important, what's also in statute or what was also a justification for the law was that it was created to give voters more confidence in the election results.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer talking with our Capitol correspondent, Mary Wilson. Mary, is there a sense in Harrisburg that this is a case tainted by political opportunism?
That's certainly something that's thrown out there by opponents. And it was certainly something that was said last year. There was a lot more pressure on the court proceedings, the decisions on this law last year, because we were running right up against a general election that was very high profile. This year, the pressure is considerably lessened. The decision probably won't. The general election in the fall is not nearly as high profile. The decision will probably be set before, well before the primary next year.
But it is still. Go ahead.
It's still said. Republicans refute it, obviously, but Democrats say that this is a law that will disenfranchise people who are less likely to have ID, and according to studies presented by anecdotal evidence and studies presented in court by challengers of the law, that those groups of people tend to be very old and very young. Those groups tend to be minorities, in particular Black, Latino, and Asian voters, and those voters tend to be registered Democrats.
So, well, let me put it to you this way. There is a governor's race in 2014. Governor Corbett is running for reelection. How much, and he's really pushing the voter ID law. So how much is riding on this trial politically for Governor Corbett?
I don't think that the I can't say that I've heard that anybody in Harrisburg thinks that the election results would be much more in Governor Corbett's favor if voter ID were the law of the land,
law of the land. Would it be a blow to him if the voter ID law was overturned or not based on the results of this trial not implemented?
It would be a blow. The law was not written by his administration. The law was a long-time project of a Republican representative in the House. His administration certainly worked on the law. They certainly worked to make it constitutional. You talk to people in his administration who will tell you that that one of the things that helped make it constitutional was that they created this special voter ID card that I referred to earlier. I think it would be a blow. I'm not sure that he based his candidacy on this at all. And I think that he has spoken in support of it, but I don't think it's a central issue for him.
Before we let you go, Mary, I know that you've been following the shakeup in Governor Corbett's office. His second chief of staff, Steve Achol, is leaving his post. What about that, and who is replacing him? This will be three chiefs of staff in 3 years.
Yeah, and if you consider that he was going to right before he took office, he had one chief of staff in mind, and scuttled that plan and brought in a new person to be his chief of staff. So it could be four if you have a really long memory. But certainly, you know, from the time he's been in office, yeah, it's going to be three chiefs of staff in less than 3 years. And it's significant in that, you know, the guy who was brought in to be his chief of staff a little over a year ago was brought in to, you know, help right a sinking ship. Well, now the ship appears to have sunk further. Low poll ratings, low job performance, I mean, you know, a nationwide study shows that he is of all the governors facing reelection, he has the lowest poll ratings in the country, and is one of the states most likely to you know, swing. On top of that, of course, I know that you've been following the failure of the governor to get his top three legislative priorities through the legislature. So this, you know, this is clearly like, you know, try again. So the legislative director is out in addition to the chief of staff.
And then five secretaries have also resigned in the past 2.5 years. Why is this happening?
Well, the secretaries I set that apart. You know, each secretary is kind of a different story. As far as his top, you know, his kitchen cabinet, it's sometimes referred to as, you know, I think it's, I've talked to people who just say it's a governor who's trying to, with every new staff member, trying to hew a little bit closer to what a politically savvy, you know, governor's administration looks like. The woman he's going to be bringing in is a woman named Leslie Gromes Baker, longtime operative for Republicans, lobbyist, fundraiser, powerful, has a lot of influence, worked with the Ridge administration. And, you know, you read the guys who really know what's going on in Harrisburg, and they say that this appointment or this hire is proof that the governor is really moving from his prosecutorial mindset, where, you know, you keep information close, you don't wheel and deal so much, to a much more politically savvy mindset, agreeing that he will take on somebody who understands the political animal and understands how to get things done when things aren't just in black and white, and when you can't just kind of, you know, bring charges and prosecute. You know, it's not that kind of mindset. You've got to get in the room with people who may have goals you don't agree with, values you don't agree with, and work out a deal if you're going to look like a success story at the end of the day.
WESA's Capitol correspondent Mary Wilson with us by phone from Harrisburg. As always, Mary, great thanks.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll look at the value of internships to students and employers and the legality that has brought scrutiny to them, the legal fight that has brought scrutiny to them. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.